Game on 2FM.
With Green Farm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks to Emma Power for her fantastic company. It's Tuesday, the 4th of May, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Mark Langdon on Mourinho's return, and can Man City finally reach a Champions League final?
The desire to do something nice for all of us in our lives, to be remembered forever, they have to make a step forward and say, okay, you are going to individually help the team to win the game. And we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We don't want to miss this opportunity, and I had the feeling we're going to do well.
Allianz Hurling League is back this weekend. We'll speak to Limerick's Sean Finn and Wexford's Dee O'Keefe.
Quick ball in Presley Chen. Gives it back for Dermot O'Keefe. Two goal remain come to challenge him. He gets inside the cover, takes a shot, and Dermot O'Keefe, who scored a point against Laois, point against Kilkenny, and he's done it now in the Leinster final against Galway.
Well, the National Hunt season is over and it was a brilliant one, so jockey Danny Mullins is with us to reflect on a season's full of firsts.
Flooring Porter's going to make all of the running to win the Stayers Hurdle for Ireland. Flooring Porter for Gavin Cromwell, a chance ride for Danny Mullins. He's won a big pot. Saïd Duberlé was second, Paisley Park third, an all the way win for Ireland in Thursday's big race. The Stayers Hurdle goes to Flooring Porter.
Now you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
To some very sad news first. The Republic of Ireland legend Alan McLaughlin has passed away at the age of just 54. The former midfielder revealed back in March that he was once again battling cancer. McLaughlin made 42 appearances for Ireland and is most fondly remembered for scoring the goal at Windsor Park that secured Ireland's place at the 1994 World Cup. It was an amazing night. I think it was probably a night that is a first for many of us. Some of us are probably our first really big sporting memory, and one that we will never forget because of Alan.
Yeah, to me it came hot off the back of Italia 90. Obviously I'm showing my age more than you, Marie, because I have a better memory of Italia 90 than I do of that campaign. But when you think back at it, like, we'd beaten Albania. This is when Ireland did well in qualifiers. We'd beaten Albania home and away. We'd beaten Latvia home and away. Lithuania home and away. Two draws against Denmark. Drew with Spain in Spain. And then they beat us 3-1 in Dublin. So you'd go up to the north to get something. Ireland are 1-0 down. You're thinking, how are they going to score? Like, they weren't even getting a kick that night in Windsor Park. And then Alan McLaughlin steps up and sticks it in the net. And you're thinking, Alan who? But you never again forgot his name. He was just Alan McLaughlin that scored in Windsor Park forevermore after that.
Well, well,
I can remember it.
Here's Dennis Irwin to take it. It's come straight out to McLaughlin! It's there! Alan McLaughlin has done it! He could not believe it. He looked for the linesman's flag, but Windsor Park is stunned into silence. Alan McLaughlin has struck gold for Ireland. His very first goal for the Republic of Ireland. Headed out by Taggart, he seized the responsibility, and the man from Portsmouth proves himself another masterstroke as a substitution. Taggart's clearance, but this is a classy finish, an unbelievable finish. The man who first came to prominence during the World Cup in Italy may well have secured the Republic's passage to the next one. Splendid strike, no chance right. 77 minutes gone, and it's one apiece, and we're back in business. If he never scores another goal in an Irish shirt, Alan McLaughlin will be a hero for the rest of his life.
He really was, and our thoughts are with all of Alan's family and friends at this really, really tough time. Now to other news today. Katie McCabe has signed a new long-term contract with Arsenal after a fantastic season with the Gunners. So she's the Republic of Ireland captain, and she has made 113 appearances since joining from Shelburne back in December 2015. She's still only 25. She's won the Women's FA Cup, the FA Women's Continental Tyres League Cup and the Barclays FA Women's Super League. So she's been absolutely fantastic for Arsenal. 24 goals this season and 12 assists. Now, if she could just only get us to a World Cup, that would just round it off perfectly for us. So look, absolutely brilliant from Katie McCabe. She really is. She's flying the flag at the very top level over in that Women's Super League, and she has shown that there's a really, really good pathway there in professional sport. And for her to sign a long-term contract as well, it's so important for her and for also for the women's game in general and for all those girls who do want to follow in her footsteps. Now, speaking of new contracts, one that I wasn't really expecting today was Jose Mourinho. He is Roma's new manager, and Mark Langdon of the Racing Post is with us to dissect it all. Mark, is it going to go right or wrong?
Yeah, I mean, you wonder what Roma fans have done to deserve this, beaten 6-2 last week and in the Europa League, and now getting Jose Mourinho as their new manager. No, they're actually really, I think, quite excited at the prospect of Mourinho taking over. It feels like a similar vibe to the one when he took over at Tottenham. You know, this was one where the club that get Mourinho had feel like they're the lucky ones initially, because, you know, he wouldn't ordinarily have looked twice at Roma and until recently. But of course, his stock has fallen to such an extent now that it feels like a kind of he's level, and that's not competing for the major trophies anymore. Roma are not going to be anywhere near the top four this season. Don't look like they've got a squad really to compete at that kind of level in the near future either. So it's another one of those where, a bit like when he took over at Tottenham, where he's saying the right things early and there's a bit of enthusiasm and energy around the place, and, you know, belief that maybe he can prove the critics wrong. But the critics have been right, haven't they, for a while now, I think. So he's got a lot on to prove he can manage at that very highest level, I think.
Like, when you think back, Mark, long enough to when he came into Chelsea, obviously Roman Abramovich was new on the scene as well, and he had wads and wads of money, and that's what propelled Chelsea to where they are. Do you think Thiago Pinto will give him any sort of that money at AS Roma?
No, I don't think so. Roma are a team that have not been able to sort of match the sort of big spenders, even in Italy, and haven't been that many big spenders in Italian football recently. You know, Juventus have got a massive wage bill with the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo on it. You look at Inter with Lukaku and players like that. Roma wouldn't have it in them to be able to buy that type of player. If anything, really, they'd been looking to get rid of Edin Dzeko, the veteran forward. They have got some younger players, but of course that's not really the type that Mourinho usually trusts. Chris Smalling is there. I'm not sure the relationship he had with Mourinho when they were together at Manchester United. Mkhitaryan, another one, former Manchester United, who is at Roma, but there isn't there just isn't that amount of funds available. I mean, I was at a game between Roma and Milan when the previous owners were eventually forced out of the club, really, that the fans turned their back on the club, walked out during the first half, and kind of forced them to relinquish control. American owners that they felt were not doing right by the club. I think it was a little bit harsh. They were trying to put in place rules and regulations that maybe stop some of those ultra fans from doing what they wanted, but the fans eventually saw them off. There isn't the kind of investment to sort of get them up challenging at the top end of Serie A, I wouldn't have thought. Their best hope is that Inter, who have got Chinese owners, may be about to pull the plug on sort of their big spending. Juventus can't really keep going as they are, so maybe the others can come back to them, but they won't be able to sort of spend the kind of money that Mourinho had at Chelsea. He probably won't even have the kind of money he had at Tottenham.
The thing about it as well is that, as you mentioned there, the fans are so vocal. I was at that Liverpool game a couple of years ago, and if things aren't going the way they want them to, they will let him know very, very quickly. But fans aside, and if you just take into consideration everything that has happened with him over the last few years, do you think players are going to actually want to go to Roma to play with him if he does even have some funds to splash out?
Yeah, I think that there are some, and I know he fell out with some players at Tottenham, but somebody like Harry Kane spoke very highly of Mourinho and the work he was doing at Tottenham. And I do think that he has this way, really, where if you're on side with him, he's absolutely fantastic, and if you're not, that's when the problems arise. And so I think there will be some players and you know, that can get that connection going with Mourinho, see what he's won in the past, and buy into that. Also, of course, Jose Mourinho's agent, Jorge Mendes, is one of the most influential men in football, really, and he's got quite a lot of players that would definitely want to sort of play for Mourinho, for sure, 100%. And I still think in Italy his stock is still high from what he did with Inter previously, and I also think in Portugal with Portuguese players he's still seen as an absolute legend of the game for what he's done throughout his career. And so in that respect, I think that there will still be players that will want to play for Jose Mourinho. Whether they will sort of after 12 months of working for him is maybe another thing, but I definitely think that he'll have that initial attraction, because he is still in terms of sort of globally recognised managers, for all that I've just mocked him there, I mean, he has won absolutely everything, and I think he's still got a very solid reputation in certain parts of Europe.
Mark, when you look back at Jose Mourinho's career, and you look at Pep Guardiola's, like, Pep was Bobby Robson's captain in Barcelona, Jose was basically his interpreter, and the way their careers have gone, why has Pep been able to keep his managerial career going longer and in the right trajectory longer than Jose has?
I think that Mourinho's ideology is probably the reason why he's struggling now. That kind of sort of win at all costs, it's almost gone out of fashion. I know that sounds sort of a bit silly, but a lot of teams now look to have a process in place, and the results will take care of themselves. If everything is done right, you know, on the training ground from a Monday to Friday, the results will take care of themselves. It's kind of the belief that a lot of the top managers have got now. And, you know, if you look at sort of the process at Manchester City, you see the work that they put in every day on the field when they go into that 90 minutes. It's often said that, if anything, Mourinho's training tactics are just not up to that kind of standard anymore. He is somebody that kind of believes in players making the difference. Like, he will sort of give them the platform and that sort of will to win and that kind of thing, and the defensive stability. He expects the attackers to kind of create it on their own, and he doesn't go through that process. That was the accusation anyway at Manchester United and Tottenham. And I think that, you know, you saw it plays to the strengths of some people, like Harry Kane and Heung-Min Son just struck up this relationship, and it was great to see. But then you look at the rest of the team, and they didn't quite perform to the same standards that they did under Pochettino, who would very much be a process manager, and there's probably not a bigger one than Pep Guardiola, you know, him and Bielsa and coaches like that. They live and die by what they do on the training ground, and I'm not sure that Mourinho's quite up to those standards, or certainly not anymore anyway.
It'll be interesting to see how it works out. You mentioned that Inter Milan have won the Serie A title, and it is Lukaku who's the hero for them. He has scored 21 goals for Antonio Conte's side.
He's been absolutely brilliant. I mean, when we're talking about best strikers in the world, Lewandowski is sort of widely regarded as it. You know, Harry Kane gets a mention. You've got Haaland and also Mbappe. But Lukaku has been as good as anybody in Europe this season. Been phenomenal. And I was one of those that sort of doubted his ability to reach that kind of level. And I felt at Manchester United, he kind of, you know, that his touch and control wasn't what you expected of an elite centre forward. He has definitely improved for working under Antonio Conte in the last couple of years. Inter believe they've got to the sort of the bottom of some of his fitness issues, changed his diet completely. He looks so much quicker, I would say, just in and stronger. He's able to bring other people into play. He's scoring more goals. He's just been absolutely phenomenal, and he goes into the European Championships sort of, you know, in a sort of month or so's time as one of the most informed strikers in world football. He's been fantastic for Inter, and it does make you wonder, with Manchester United potentially looking to sign a striker of that kind of ilk for that kind of money that they lost Lukaku for, you know, what might have been had they sort of persevered with him and maybe coached him and got more out of him, just like Conte has.
Is there an argument, Mark, that the pace of Italian football suits him better than the Premier League?
I think that you could, and some people definitely do argue that. I tend to think, actually, though, that that would be doing a disservice maybe to some of the top teams in Italy, but also a slight disservice to Lukaku himself for the improvements that he has made to his game. And I think he's definitely made, you know, more sacrifices, you know, to please Antonio Conte. Conte is one of the world's most demanding coaches, and I think that it's that relationship, really, like Conte driving Lukaku to be better, to not accept for, you know, just being you know, a really good striker and turning him into one of the world's best. And I'm sure if he came back to the Premier League now, he would be right up there with any of the others that are in England at the moment. He's playing to a really high level, and I think we'll see that in the European Championships as well.
My memory has just deserted me. Who did he play under at Man United? Was he in charge at the time?
Yeah, he was definitely he was definitely there under Jose Mourinho, and also I think there was a bit of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well, wasn't it? It was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer that eventually decided that,
you know, United could
just decided that they cashed in on Lukaku's services. But I mean, there was a big tug of war between Manchester United and Chelsea to get Lukaku in the first place, and Conte wanted him desperately at Chelsea when he'd already left the club, of course, once before. He wanted to bring him back. He turned to Manchester United instead. And Conte, I think, has realised them two have got a good thing going between them. Now, with Inter's sort of financial problems that I mentioned earlier on in the show, it is going to be a bit of a fight to keep him, because I think everybody has their price at Inter this summer.
So moving on then to PSG and Manchester City tonight in the Champions League. So just to add a little bit of another layer to it, Alex Ferguson was pictured today visiting the PSG hotel ahead of this game. He's always been a fan, we know, of Mauricio Pochettino. They became friends back in 2013. So the photographer said that he spent 1 hour and 20 minutes inside the hotel before leaving when he was pictured again. Ruby, I'm going to go to you because you know the man. Would he be good for a team talk?
He would, actually, Marie. I went to a game many years ago in Lisbon with Johnny Murta. United were playing Benfica, I think, in a European Cup game, and Johnny was riding from at the time. I'd ridden Minnesota as well, and we ended up at the back of a team talk, and he did give quite a good one.
I didn't know that before I asked.
I didn't. Just throwing it in there. We were obviously getting the tickets off him as well. But yeah, that hairdryer is not a myth.
Would he have done that ever with jockeys?
No, he didn't. Actually, I remember going to a European Cup game in Old Trafford on the Wednesday night before entry one night, and United got beat. They were beaten even. There were a couple of goals up. They ended up getting beaten 3-2 or something at home. And I wrote a winner from the next day in entry, and what a friend. So I was saying, like, I was coming back in, you could have done with me a cornerback last night. And he was laughing. So no, he never gave me instructions.
Right, well, that's really interesting. Mark, just on him going into the hotel today, has there been any more of a confirmation, or any confirmation really, that he was giving a team talk, or was he just in having a coffee with his friend Poch?
I think it was more a coffee with Mauricio Pochettino. Of course, you mentioned there the two did become close. They were pictured leaving a very swanky London restaurant together in Mayfair, and that was around the time when there was talk that he would, you know, become Manchester United's next manager. Maybe the two have remained close. I think Pochettino just feels like he should manage Manchester United one day. He's kind of his ethos, I think, sort of suits the club. I think he would be perfect for them. Of course, he's got a big job on at the moment. He could do with all the help he can get, because 2-1 down against Manchester City, and Mbappe not fully fit to the point where, you know, there's been a lot of suggestions that he wouldn't be able to start this game. They've got a big job on to, you know, save their European season tonight. So any help they could get, gladly received, I think.
So, but like Mark, City have won all 5 of their Champions League games at home and only conceded 2 goals. whose background is that going on in, guys? Yeah, Marie's looking at me. It's not here, Marie, whatever that noise is.
I think it's heavy rain in battering against my roof. I'll try and move out the way. Sorry.
No, that's all right. Just I knew Marie was looking at me. She's thinking, what are these two at now? But anyways, like City have been brilliant, obviously, in the Premier League, but even in the Champions League, they've only conceded twice at the Etihad. Like, PSG face a mammoth task, don't they?
That they do. I felt in the first half of that first leg, Paris Saint-Germain played as well as they could. They were all over City. They couldn't sustain that for 90 minutes. And I think that's the problem. You can play at that kind of pace maybe for 45 minutes, but maintaining it for 90, it's almost impossible. And if you sit off Man City, as invariably Paris Saint-Germain had to do in that second half, they were then ripped apart. I'm sure it'll be another really exciting game. I think that they're two of the best teams in Europe, no doubt about that. City are the best team in Europe, and Paris showed in that first half that they're not a million miles off. But I suspect at some stage, as Paris have to open up, they've got to score two goals to stay in the tie. They'll get killed really eventually by just the sheer quality of Manchester City, and it will be seen as a failure in Paris because they want to win the Champions League. I think what we saw last week is they're still a little bit off the absolute sort of peak, and that is Pep Guardiola's team.
We know that Neymar hasn't endeared himself to football fans all around the world, but we've seen what he is capable of when he does turn it on. Does he have enough in his locker to rescue his team if they don't have a fully fit Mbappe?
Yeah, I think he's got that in him. In the game against Bayern Munich, he missed some chances, but I thought his general play in that tie was as good as you can get, really. And yeah, he has got it in him to be able to play at that level. I think the problem for Paris is going to be defensively, because they're fine at centre-back, but I think in the full-back areas, they haven't spent the kind of money that you really need to be able to compete. If you think about Manchester City, they've spent 50 million on Cancelo, another 50 million on Walker, what was it, nearly 50 million on Mendy. Paris Saint-Germain, they've got a guy playing left-back for them called Bakker, and there was a clip from the first leg where Riyad Mahrez actually said to him, like, who are you? This is a guy that plays for Paris Saint-Germain, but probably wouldn't be recognised outside of sort of PSG's hardcore supporters. And what Paris have done is they've spent all their money in the glory positions and left themselves a little bit short in some of, and just tried to fill holes at right back and left back. But, when you go up at the very highest level, you get found out. If you haven't got, a 1-11 that can play at the highest level, and, I felt Riyad Mahrez was one of the best players on the pitch last week. He was up against Bakker, who, wouldn't get near the Manchester City team, if we're being brutally honest, and that's the difference, I think. So Neymar, I'd have absolutely no problem that he could carry Paris Saint-Germain going forward. It's just in some of them sort of other positions where I think PSG is still a little bit short, which sounds ridiculous given how much money they've spent, but they've gone all out in certain positions and not quite found the right balance when we're talking about Champions League semi-finals and Champions League finals. I think that they're nearly there, but they're not quite, and I expect it to be probably another near miss tonight.
Mark, it is remarkable when you think that City have played 34 games in the Premier League. They went a long way in most of the competitions, but they have a fully fit squad to choose from tonight. And that's some good.
It is, yeah, and I think that is testament to Pep Guardiola's ability to keep everybody happy. Their squad is enormous, but that can bring with it its own problems, because how do you make sure all of those players are onside and ready to do the business when they are called upon? And yet they are. You have a look at his second team, and they've spent a lot of money, and Pep Guardiola has made reference to the fact that they have spent an absolute fortune. Nathan Aki, was it 40 million on him? You barely remember that he plays for Manchester City, and he would get into a lot of Premier League teams, and their second 11 with Laporte and Ake at centre-back and Fernandinho in midfield, and Raheem Sterling can't get in the first team at the moment on a regular basis. Sergio Aguero, Gabriel Jesus. Keeping all of these players happy is a skill within itself. And you asked a question earlier on, Ruby, about maybe the difference between Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. I think that would be another one. Mourinho if you're not playing for him, he's not one to keep everybody happy. And I think Pep Guardiola has a much cuter way of doing it, you know, so he keeps everybody on board. Winning helps, and winning trophies is the easiest way, I suppose, to keep people happy. But it's still a difficult job to make sure that all of those players are ticking along, and you barely ever hear anybody moaning about not starting for Manchester City.
It'll be interesting when his team lineup does come out, because everybody knows now at this stage he finds it really hard to resist the temptation of doing something dramatic with his selection. He overthinks everything so much. But it, even on the sideline, it is an interesting battle between Guardiola and Pochettino.
He is, absolutely. And, you know, Pep Guardiola, I think, has made some really bizarre tactical choices down the years in Champions League matches. I didn't feel like he did that in the first leg against Paris Saint-Germain. He sort of kept true to sort of what he has been doing. So he didn't have a striker in the starting 11, but he's played a lot of games this season without a striker, and it's not like he suddenly decided to do that for the biggest game of the season. I think that maybe he has learnt his lessons from that. If you go back to last year, he completely changed his team to match up to Lyon. And, you know, you look at the two teams on paper and think, why? You just don't need to do that. You're Manchester City, just beat Lyon with the 11 you've got on the pitch. But he obsesses over football, he obsesses over the opposition, so it wouldn't be a massive surprise if he did something that that was, I suppose, unexpected. But I think they played so well in the first leg that it would be a mistake if he went too far off, you know, what City have done well for so long this season.
He's fairly certain to play De Bruyne. He'll probably play Mahrez, but does he put Foden or Aguero up front?
I mean, I would have thought that Foden would play ahead of Aguero at the moment. Foden has developed into sort of one of the key men, really, of the team. Aguero popped up with that important goal against Crystal Palace, but Foden's football in sort of this calendar year has been as good as anybody at Manchester City. And when you think they've got Mahrez and De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva and Gundogan and players like that in the team, for him to be at that level is pretty remarkable for a 20-year-old. But it would be that would be a surprise if Foden wasn't in the team. In terms of who actually starts up front, it could be Foden, it could be Bernardo Silva, it could be Kevin De Bruyne. You're never quite sure, and it's a very fluid formation for City, and you know, it could be that all three of them end up in that position at some stage, and that in itself is a complication for Paris Saint-Germain. But in terms of sort of surprise selections, it would be a shock if Foden wasn't in that team.
So we are going to be previewing the Real Madrid-Chelsea game in depth tomorrow. But if Manchester City do progress, who do you think they're going to be playing, Mark?
Chelsea, I think, in the final. Real Madrid, I sort of say it's half in jest, but the three Champions League triumphs that they've won kind of cover up some serious issues that they've got, really. And this team is now past its best, relies heavily on Karim Benzema for goals. Outside of set pieces, they don't really create an awful amount of chances. They've got a very organised team, a very experienced team. But I would be disappointed if I was Chelsea and you went out from the position they've got themselves in with the away goal with a 1-1 draw. I think Liverpool beat themselves in that quarter-final game against Real Madrid. And if Chelsea play to the standards they've set under Thomas Tuchel, they really should be getting through the semi-final.
With a bit of luck, Mark Langdon. Thanks a million. Stay in out of that rain. We're going to take a break.
Your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets, available in selected stores nationwide. Game on.
Hurling. Now, the long awaited return of Intercounty Hurling takes place on May the 8th with the commencement of the Allianz Hurling Leagues. Over 70 games will take place across the four divisions in an action packed 7-week festival of hurling. This campaign also marks the 29th year of Allianz partnership with the GAA as sponsor of the Allianz Leagues, making it one of the longest running sponsorships in Irish sport. I'm delighted to say that we are joined now by Sean Finn of Limerick and Dermot O'Keefe of Wexford to look ahead to the weekend. Sean and Dermot, You're so very welcome. Sean, to you first. I think everybody is crying out for hurling, so there's no pressure on you now.
No, absolutely not. I'm actually one of those included. Obviously lucky to be involved so late in the year last year and really enjoyed the time off now since December, but couldn't wait now to get back training two and a half weeks ago, so really looking forward to the league starting Saturday.
Yeah, I think everybody is. And Diarmaid, just it's been a strange year. Is there a bit of a sense of normality now when you do go back in training? Does it feel like it always had before?
Yeah, I think so, Marie. I suppose, look, we've been off for three or four months now, and when you get back into the dressing room with the lads, the crack is still good. You kind of take off where you've left off in the year before, and you get back with the lads, and you just get back into the swing of things and back into the norm, and it happens to quickly, to be honest.
Sean Dermot's on about getting back into the dressing room there and meeting the lads again. I'm sure you've been doing plenty on your own, but were you like a bunch of kids back at school for the first day when you headed back into the dressing room?
Yeah, for sure. Kyle Hayes and Keane Lynch do a lot of rowing and shouting, so that noise was music to a lot of lads' ears. But yeah, it was a great buzz, of course. You can't replicate getting together in a dressing room and a pitch. You can do your own bit for a couple of weeks leading up to training, but it was fantastic just to get in there 2 weeks ago, and the buzz there. You can feel the freshness and the energy of fellas in the dressing room, you know, and that can be seen on the training field. That lads are fresh and really looking forward to the next couple of weeks.
And Diarmaid, a lot of people have used the last year or so to reflect on life and put their values on different parts of their existences. Is Davey a lot more calmer now that he's back?
Really, I think you know the answer to that. I don't think I need to say it no more. No, he's look, he was raring to go. We spoke about the coaches being excited and stuff. He was raring to go with the lads from the first night that we were back in, and he had done a lot of planning, a lot of reflecting on the season just gone last year. So was he calmer? No, I don't think so. But we're used to him at this stage now, so we know what to expect.
Sean, I can imagine Davey Fitz was sending the lads in Wexford WhatsApp messages on the 26th of December to make sure they were doing something. But look, for you yourself, you obviously did a cruciate in 2016. Was that something you had to be very mindful of through a closed season like this, to keep an eye on an injury like that, a severe one as that could reoccur?
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously a lot of people you hear, even in the Premier League at that level, there's ACL injuries coming up, but nothing that I, like, after the first year in 2017, when you saw that year through injury free, nothing that would come into your mind. But of course, you do your pre-activation stuff and do whatever you can to limit the likelihood of you picking up an injury like that. But the short season, you try to manage your load as much as possible, like a lot of teams in the country that just player management and stuff. But you do what you can, but sometimes it's just unfortunate for those cruciate injuries to occur, you know.
Yeah, we saw a couple of Cork footballers, unfortunately, theirs last week, which is really tough on them. And like, I guess you do have to look at the run-in and the fact that it is so short, Sean, which must be a bit of a worry.
I suppose a lot of it is trust in your coaches that they're actually, the load is, and I suppose listen to your own body to know when you're tired and stuff. But the strength and conditioning lads that we have and the coaches we have are already clued into what the fellas and the energy in the camp. So there's a lot of measures in place there to just make sure we're at the right level at the right time, you know. But of course, you're going to have to be cognizant of maybe overtraining and trying to get too much in a short period of time. And look, we can only deal with what the cards are dealt with, and the next couple of weeks we just try to fit as much as we can in, but because of that, we don't need to do too much either.
Dermot, just listen to Sean there and being conscious of not overtraining. How do you manage to keep a rein on Davey that he doesn't overtrain you?
That's a difficult question to answer, to be honest.
Go on, give us an answer.
we had 3 to 4 months of being by ourselves, and I suppose the training to game ratio as well was probably imbalanced, and it was, I suppose, look, just the training case and managing your training load yourself. I think from my point of view, I've been there now 8-9 years, and you kind of get the grips of what works when you're training on your own and what doesn't work, more to the point. So just trying to manage it yourself as best you can. Like Sean mentioned, listening to your own body, you know, you get pretty familiar with what works and what doesn't work for you. So you're just trying to chat to the coaches, you know, chat to the physio. If there's work that needs to be done, or chat to the SNC guys as well, to manage that load as best as possible.
As Dermot is saying, there's been improvements in Wexford since Davy came along, and likewise in Limerick. But when you're looking at John Kelly now going back in after winning two All-Irelands in the last 3 years, winning back-to-back leagues, can you see the pressure on him of the expectation in Limerick, or is he still just taking it all in his stride?
Yeah, I think John's a cool guy. He'll take a lot of it in his stride, but a lot of the noise is external, and it's just important that doesn't creep into the camp, you know. We can only look after the controls like we can control, and we just focus on ourselves and take each week comes, and we know if we hit the targets and hit the standards that we do expect of ourselves at the weekend in the games, that we will be in a chance to win those games. So a lot of the noise that there is expectations of us, we expect that of ourselves. So if we meet those, we will be in a good chance. But it's just important that those don't creep into the camp, you know.
Sean, you mentioned the noise there, and like being from so close to Limerick, I know exactly what you're talking about. But Dunnigan must know as well, because Munster rugby probably did take a lot of that attention for so long, but it's very much now surrounding the Limerick hurlers, like the excitement, the good days. It's taken the focus away from rugby now and very much on hurling.
Yeah, well, I suppose really that comes with success really over the last couple of years. Obviously, Munster had their fair share of success, and a lot of young people in the county would have liked to play rugby with Munster and that and the club scene. But look, when you're successful and there's teams like Limerick hurling their success at the moment, of course there's going to be young lads that are going to want to be playing with Limerick. And look, we wouldn't be having this conversation 3 years ago if Limerick weren't in a position of winning in All-Ireland. So Limerick's a great sporting county, and for both rugby, soccer and Gaelic games. But at the moment, Limerick are flying high in the hurling, and long may that continue.
Sean, all the good ones seem to come from Bruff. That's what I've learned.
That is, yeah.
Dermot, just on it, we chat about the crack of training and being back to it, and you can imagine there is certain fitness levels you need to get to, but how much detail are you doing at the moment? How much getting match ready and preparation and systems are you working on?
Yeah, I took plenty of time off, took a good couple of weeks off, and the nature fellas at that level are going to do that element of training, whether it be in the gym or on the field. But yeah, going in training on the pitch, of course the body will be tired after the first 2 weeks, and it was a tough 2 weeks of training, but you can't replicate games either. And looking forward to get to 70 minutes or so into the legs next weekend, and as the next couple of weekends go, you'd expect the hurling to improve as well, you know. But a lot of the running woods and stuff like that today, the running up and down the field or maybe are gone, but a lot of that running is employed into tough drills laid out by the coaches.
Sean, I mean, obviously Limerick in the league last year were outstanding. I mean, you won all 5 of 5. You beat Tipp, Galway, Waterford, Cork and Westmeath. Would you be thinking that you're in a similar position to attack the league the same way this year?
I think so. I think we obviously take the league seriously, and that is probably shown in the last 2 years, considering we've come out on top in those 2 years. But we've just applied ourselves well to each game and look to win each game and take each weekend as it comes, you know. And again, I go back to, we just focus on ourselves and hitting those level of expectations we have of ourselves. And look, of course, how close the league is to the championship will play a part too, in that you want to perform in the league, which will carry into the championship. You can't just turn it on a week before the championship game and expect to have a performance that was new. So you get a win and a championship day. So, of course, you're going to want a good level of performance in the league. With that momentum then carrying into the championship.
There's a lot of focus now on the new rules heading into the league, and they are adding a little bit of excitement because we don't know how they're going to unfold in general play. So the one that a lot of people are looking at is the cynical one. So a player who cynically fouls an opponent, denying him a clear goal scoring opportunity, will be sin binned by way of a yellow card if the incident happens within the 20 metre line or the D, and his team will concede a penalty. There's a lot to unpack with that, really, and I can't imagine how difficult it would be to try and determine in the moment what the punishment should be.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't actually know the rule myself. So it'll be something I most probably discuss during the week with a couple of lads. But, of course, it's going to be really hard to referee from a referee's perspective, especially if there's like the speed of the game and the position where the foul is committed, and the forward is so cute nowadays that they're able to orchestrate a free out of nothing. So it'll be hard to decide whether that was a deliberate foul by a defender or was it a forward that's trying to win a free, a handy free. So I must get to know that rule a bit more, but it's certainly going to be a hot topic over the summer, I've no doubt.
You'd think for a cornerback like that, it'd be fairly high up on your agenda, as you might know, like, seeing as you could be inside the 20 a fair bit.
It will be this week, but there has to be a plan, I suppose, in those situations of what you do with a player if you're really exposed in a goal threat. But it's going to be really difficult to referee and difficult to decide whether it's actually a foul or deliberate.
And do you think, Dermot, that it is going to eradicate cynical play from hurling?
If it's policed properly, and I think it's still up for debate at this stage. I know the first time we spoke about it in Wexford was on Sunday morning, and I even didn't realise myself if someone is deliberately pulled down on the corner flag, yet it's inside the 21, it goes back for a penalty straight away, even if it is out on the sideline. So, look, if it's policed at the moment properly, as I said, it's like the refs have so much other things to be worried about, and it's happened so fast that it can be a problem. Then of course it'll work out, but still up for the debate at this stage, to be honest.
Sean, just looking at it, have you talked at all about changing the system if someone is sent off? Would you manipulate the space in a different way when you have that advantage?
Yeah, it's going to be something that's going to have to be spoken about, isn't it? In that, what's your plan for the 10 minutes that the player is out? Do you drop a man back? Do you bring a fella in? You carry the ball more? About certainly one that it must be spoken about, because it's inevitable that you're going to be in a scenario where you're going to be down to 14 men at some stage over the next 6-10 games, you know. So it'll be quite interesting, and I think it'll be very topical over the summer and over the league campaign how referees deal with it.
Ruby's having none of this, by the way. He doesn't believe a word that you're saying, that you haven't practiced this.
Not a word. I was sitting there laughing, thinking, like, that's like two lads sitting in the air room. What are you doing? I haven't a clue. Didn't even know I was riding in this race. Are you riding this race as well? No, I hadn't. It's a Scooby-Doo. Huh? Really? Paul, I wouldn't play poker with either of you anyway. Know that.
And Sean, look, Tipperary, first up, I think when it comes to hurling matches, I know it's the league, it doesn't really get much bigger than that, and especially when we haven't had it for so long and we're looking forward to it and we're mad for a bit of sport, it should be a good contest.
Yeah, it should be. We've a good 3 weeks work done. Tipperary will of course be the same. You mightn't get the hurling that you might expect in the summer, but you're two teams that are going to go hell for leather at it, and of course there's a rivalry between ourselves and Tip. So Tipperary are a good hurling team. We're decent as well, and I'm sure it'll be something that a lot of people around the county will be looking forward to.
And likewise, Dee, as well, like playing Laois, Cheddar's back in charge, and they're always going to get a bounce when there's a new manager in there.
Yeah, you said it, Cheddar's back in charge, and each of the lads will be hoping to put a stake claim there for a position on team. They'll be looking to get a good start off. It's a nice game for us. It'll be a home game, the first game out, and, you know, kind of gives us a marginal advantage, you know, so. Yeah, look, it's everyone's going hell for leather. It should be a good game, and hopefully we get a win on the board.
Absolutely. Well, we all hope anyway. There's some good games this weekend, and there should be for sure.
I just hope you learn the rules by the weekend, lads.
I have the rule book out tonight, Jerry.
Yeah, best of luck now. Here's your study for the weekend.
Game on. Hurling. Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back now. Two bits of news to start with. Jack Chambers, the TD, has, or should I say the Deputy Minister for Sport, Junior Minister for Sport, has tweeted that he is happy to confirm that non-playing members of inter-county panels may attend games when the league season starts. All members of panels make a significant contribution to the performance of their county, and it is important that it is recognised. And we also have the Manchester City team. So there's Edison Walker, Diaz, Stone, Sinchenko, Fernandinho, Gundogan, Bernardo, Mahrez, Foden and De Bruyne.
No Silva.
No Sterling. Interesting team. Right, let us move on now to horse racing. And I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line by Danny Mullins. Danny, how are things? Thanks so much for joining us.
It's all good, yeah. It's great to be on.
It is, and it's great to have you. We're sick of talking racing with Ruby, so it's nice to have a different voice for a change.
Yeah, it's good. Ruby, he gets it right most of the time, but it's good to give an opinion.
I am listening, Danny, so I was kind of glad you were a little bit careful there most of the time, yeah. But Danny, the season has come to a conclusion, or came to a conclusion last Saturday in Punchestown, and for Ireland, for National Hunt trainers, jockeys, owners, etc., it was an incredible season.
Yeah, it was an unbelievable season. To see how the Irish horses performed so well at Cheltenham was great, and then again at Aintree, and capped it off with Rachel Blackmore winning the Aintree National, was a fantastic promotion for the sport. Good all round.
I was having a little giggle this morning when we were in work, when I asked you would you come on the radio, just in case people are wondering where I nabbed you, but you were there. There was no sign of Paul Townend, no sign of Rachel Blackmore, no sign of Brian Hayes. I mean, it's all gone to their head straight away, hasn't it?
They're just resting on their laurels. They don't realise the season has started and they're back at zero again.
I know, look at the Jordan Gaines for the couple of winners yesterday in the North, a couple again today in Ballinrobe. They'd want to cotton on again, the two of them, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, they mightn't be under as much pressure going into Punchestown next year if they just get them early season winners. But I'll be happy enough if I can keep Paul Townend out for another few weeks.
Keep him on the sidelines. Look, you had a remarkable season yourself. Obviously, Ken Boy won the Paddy Power Irish Gold Cup via Colreevy at Christmas. A winner at Cheltenham on Foreign Porter, Colreevy in Punchestown, Stormy Island. It was, like, numerically, it was down a bit with COVID season. It didn't start till later, but... And for big races, it was without doubt your best.
Definitely, as I said, numbers were down a little bit, but the fact that I rode so many big winners, and Flor and Porter was probably the best of them to get that one in Cheltenham, and the fact that it was a spare ride as well, it brought me from season to season where I'm starting to get into a position where I can pick up those big spares on the days in the likes of Cheltenham, and that's very important.
Before I move on to pick Ruby up on Flooring Porter, just a little bit of team news. Mbappe is on the bench for PSG, and of Ruby, of course, Bernardo is Bernardo Silva. Between the two of us now, we should have copped that one.
But sorry, I was reading the Racing Post team sheet here.
Flooring Porter, Danny, Ruby completely underestimated Flooring Porter for the last while. When Ruby underestimates a horse or doesn't think it's going to go well, does he tell you?
Not really, and to be fair, in the lead-up to Cheltenham, I didn't think it would really work out as well. Most of the previews I'd done, I thought that Johnny Moore was going to have a hell of a time over there. And as it worked out, he was very well behaved on the day and put in the performance of a lifetime.
Yeah, because when you watched him in Punchestown last week and it went pear-shaped for him going to the start, I mean, had you any moments worrying Cheltenham between the parade ring, the start? It couldn't have went any worse than it did in Punchestown.
Yeah, things just went so wrong in Punchestown. But in Cheltenham, mentally he was very relaxed all the way. And I suppose that's when you're dealing with animals, it's a case of just keeping it in their mind. You can't tell them. You can show them and ask them, but you can't tell them what to do. And, that's all on the day.
Obviously, Rachel Blackmore and Henry de Bromhead garnered all the headlines out of Cheltenham, but there were other people that it was a big meeting for. Obviously, yourself and Gavin Cromwell, but Paul Hennessy and Richie Condon, Paul Nolan and Brian Cooper, Mrs. Milner, the Shunter for Emmett Mullins and Jordan Gainsford, Belfast Banter for Peter Fahey and Kevin Sexton. It wasn't just concentrated in a couple of camps. The success was well spread.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, there's a few small camps that were competing on the biggest stage. That's very important too. You see the big names, that are winning regularly, which they need to do that. But to see small camps doing it, it's great for the game. And that's what National Hunt Racing is about. A small man can get in and compete with the kings of it.
And for you personally then, Danny, do you feel like you're really kind of building momentum?
Definitely, That winner in Cheltenham really capped off a great season, and hopefully going forward next year I can get plenty more of those type of winners. And that's what you put in the hard yards for. You put in all that work and keep yourself in the best shape so you can deliver on those days and hopefully more of it next year.
You started off so young, and when you look at where you are now and everything that happened in between, where do you think you've improved and developed?
I suppose when I started off, like, I was with Jim Bulger back in my early days, and I think my second ride on the flat, I claimed 10 pounds off 8'4", which was 7'8" in the Curra. I was a little whippet, really. And I presumed at that stage that I would have ridden on the flat for most of my career. But as time went on, I just started to get heavier. And I knew my future was going to lie riding over jumps, so I just had to adjust. And I was just very weak riding over jumps in my early days, and had to put in a lot of work to develop physically and adjust my riding style to it. And, you know, the last few seasons have really reaped the rewards of that.
I've always been fascinated when that happens to a jockey, when they think they're going to be one thing and all of a sudden their body decides they're going to be something different. Is that difficult to cope with and to adjust?
I suppose it is, in a way. You know, you have to sit down and put in a lot of work, because nobody else believes that you can do it. And I suppose there's plenty of other sports where people doubt them, and you really have to put in the work to bring yourself to the level. And once you can achieve the results, then everybody else will jump on the bandwagon and start to support you more.
Did you ever doubt yourself then, or was it just other people?
Never. There was times where I knew I wasn't good enough. I knew I could get better, but I always believed I could, but I wasn't under any illusion that I was being hard done by. I knew that I needed to improve myself to get to where I am now.
And do you think that mentality has stood you in good stead? I mean, often at times in Willys, David Mullins retired this season, he would have gone ahead of you in the pecking order. You would have been behind Paul, who was behind me. Did you think you had to have that mentality, or was it just one you had?
I've always had that mentality, but I suppose in sport, if you get caught in entitlement, it's a very sorry place. You just have to have the gratitude for what you've got and keep going to get more.
Is it hard, though, not to get caught up in the entitlement when you just consider your second name and the perception that people might have because you have that second name?
I don't think so. You know, I suppose especially with Willie, your name just doesn't really come into it. Your results do. And, you know, there's plenty of times I've been put on the bench when I didn't perform as well as I could have. And that stands to you going forward. And I suppose some people, you know, they can sulk for the likes of those situations. But to me, you never lose. You win or you learn, and you get better and move forward.
And obviously you did win, you did learn, and last week was incredible. I mean, to round up the season on Saturday with a double on Mr. Fog Patches and Stormy Island. And I suppose you can tell Marie the story. Explain about going to Ayr to ride Mr. Fog Patches. this is a good one.
Yeah, so it's not the most...
Danny is now... Danny has his communion monies. This is going to kill him.
So with no flight, direct flight to Glasgow, and I had to get connecting flight through Heathrow, and through one thing and another, which a few COVID delays, the other passengers on the first flight got delayed. I'm in Heathrow, and I get down to the gate for my next flight, and they're 32 minutes beforehand, and they tell me British Airways close at 35 minutes beforehand. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I'm after missing two favourites in Tremor for Willie that actually won, and I have the ride on the favourite for the Scottish National, and I'm not going to be able to get there. So I rang a good friend of mine, Martin Harley, who used to ride with me and Jim Bulger's, and asked him would he be able to organise a plane for me to get up, and he said there's only one man that will be able to do that, was Jamie Spencer. In fairness to Jamie, I rang him, told him the story, and he said, give me 10 minutes and I'll call you back. So he calls me back in 10 minutes and said, there's a private plane waiting for me on a runway at 20 minutes from Heathrow. Get myself there. It'll be ready to go in an hour. So that was grand. I get on the plane. But to add to that, I actually had a pound to lose. So I had my sweating gear on me. And Well, I was in my shirt in Heathrow, but I had my sweating gear in the bag, and I had to go into the toilet in Heathrow, change into all my sweating and running gear, and I'm walking out of Heathrow thinking that the security are thinking, oh my God, who is this guy now coming out with extra bags out of the toilet? But we got there anyway, ran the track, and he ran well, finished third, and came back to Punchestown to get his due reward and win there.
You see, you look at other sports people, get bussed into stadiums, guard escorts, the whole lot. Look what Danny Mullins had to do. Danny, thanks a million for taking our call. It's been a pleasure. Marie and Dunnick will be back tomorrow evening. I'm finished till next week, though.
New cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.